sometimes I feel they're just touching one another, and sometimes I feel it's just one big thing that he's cut up into pies, you know, for us or whatever it may be. I don't know what your image is. I'm looking for images of what he's doing with the paths. The paths seem to be, you know, ways to go. A path seems to go in a direction. And how do you get them all together when you're talking about paths? They cross, they intersect, they weave back and forth. Maybe saying it another way, I hope this is positive. I'm struggling with the intersections of it all. I just see them so interwoven that the word path is a little uncomfortable for me. So whatever you may feel about that. Our goal, repeat again, is two things. To get inside as much as we can of what Fox is saying, to cut through whatever we might not like about it, or maybe I don't understand about it, because we've said, as I've said a couple of times, it's not the best, world's best written book, not with clarity. But to do that, and then to examine it, evaluate it, expand it, focus it, or whatever it is, through our own experience. And that second part is as critical, obviously, as the first. The way I'm going to suggest we get at that first path again today, we had two groups that reported last time and two groups that didn't. If you don't mind, having done some of that work, I'd like to just break up into groups again, and the first groups that I would assign will pick up the thing that we had last time, and just and maybe redo it again, or maybe some other people would be doing it. Can I ask you to divide into groups? How about if every other person, you know, Dan and Karen and Reed would be a group, and Sandy and Linda and they would be a group, and then Kathleen and Carolyn and David and June, Karen and Carol and
Elmer. Comes out even. I need to do some Xerox.
Okay. Well, why don't you, join back? And if the two of you and Beth, would you be in a group? Is that all right? Okay. So that would be one, two. The order in which I gave them would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Would one tackle the art of savoring in the in theme number? What is it? Is it 3? 2. Yeah, basically on page 52, but it's spread through there. What does that mean, and what's about? What's your experience of it? What ought we be learning from that? Okay.
What group is that?
That's the first group.
Okay.
That number. The second group, if you take the one on humility, which is the third theme, humility is earthiness, and don't ignore the quote from Wendell Berry on page 65. Okay, if you somehow include that in your thing, I think it does the job of pulling it together. The third group would tackle theme 5, trust. And again, I would ask you, don't ignore the line in there, I forget what page it's on, even death is to be trusted. And the, there's 1, 2, 3, 4. The fourth group would take theme 7, royal personhood, and particularly don't ignore Stendhal's, Christopher Stendhal's quotation on page 101. I think that's a good one. You had a little bit of the continuing meditation that each one of those spots are. Can we just have some word from each of the groups give us a feel for what you were talking about. We'll start with number one, who we're talking about befriending blessing and the art of savoring of pleasure. Want to lead off? Whoever was in that group, or Karen, you and Dan, huh?
I never leave them.
Oh. You don't do that, huh? Wait, we're still trying to do it with us up here again, you know, that we're trying to get some, find out what Fox is sharing and how does that gel with what you know, feel, touch, whatever.
I guess in terms of feelings and stuff, one of the things I picked up on was that, on page 44, it talks about, like any parent, God loves her creation, and that love is an unconditional sending forth into existence, is blessing. I guess I really always felt that, only I've never been taught to feel it. Mm-hmm. Through my life and everything. So that's one of the things that's just kind of natural, is to feel that that it is an unconditional thing. Mm-hmm. And it's just there.
Ree?
One of the things we mentioned on page 46 was he was talking about fall redemption theology has ignored the blessing that creation is because of its anthropomorphic preoccupation with sin. The result has been, among other things, the loss of pleasure from spirituality, and with this loss, the increase of pain, of injustice, of sadomasochism, and of distrust. And there, it's just like we have a real tendency to accept science as absolute truth. Mm-hmm. And it really seems to be relative with the times only. And so we make judgments and we follow current trends without keeping our minds centered on where it really should be. And I guess that's where this art of savoring comes in. On page 52, he's got two quotes in the main paragraph. In my note from the first in our program, that was, there is so much in the world to savor that it is unfortunate not to savor at all. The source of all authentic pleasure is God. Anyone who has taken time to savor the blessings of life knows that they are profoundly, deliciously, deeply sweet and natural. So I guess he's just trying to say, hey, you know, you got a wonderful world here. Let's quit being so negative and ridiculing ourselves with this original sin. Mm-hmm. And let's look at creation and start to enjoy the world and share it with everybody.
Okay.
It's a word of just truly enjoy the blessings. You know, could you almost say savor? He means enjoy. Mm-hmm. And it raises the question, how does that relate to the old word hedonism?
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference?
Yeah. In between his word
hedonism.
The word pleasure and hedonism, for instance, that he uses. In
or to the manna, spirituality. Does savoring mean that one savors without possessing? That comes later in here. That the challenge is to enjoy to the fullest without trying to get and hold and hang on to it.
That image. That was a beautiful image where he says, if something is offered to you in an open hand, that means that you could look at it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you must take it.
Mm-hmm. Is that
very interesting?
Mm-hmm. our often our enjoyment, our pleasuring, is in what we can possess, what we grab, as you say, and hold on to for ourselves, but to enjoy what is there, or is offered to us, or as the creation is offered to us. That his line about that creation is the primary scripture. It's the primary written word, if you will, energized word that's given to us, and to savor that creation, even though we don't own it or possess it or hang on to it. The temptation, I think, as you're implying, is when you ask the word hedonism, it's a very easy line to say, I'm going to end up in that the hedonism or the enjoyment itself is the thing rather, is the pleasure, is it, rather than the giver who provides the whole. But those are not, I wouldn't distinguish by them too much either. Otherwise we cut it up too fine.
I'm thinking of when we give like a Christmas present, how much we enjoy if the person we give it to is enjoying it.
Savoring and enjoying
savoring it.
Mm-hmm.
How hurt we are if the opposite.
Okay.
I had a real problem with this paragraph on page 54. Talking about deliverance and, or the distinguishing between deliverance and blessing and how they relate. At the end, the last sentence, or the last part of the sentence, it says that blessing delivers because it builds trust, pride, and hope. And these are absolutely essential ingredients by which a people can deliver themselves and thus be responsible instruments of a blessing saving God. My reaction to that is that that the people that are blessed by the manna still have to keep themselves in check by not wanting to hoard it. And that even the manna can be abused, so how does that, how does deliverance fit into that?
I think in via negativa, the next one, he comes at it very directly, but what, if you can be blunt about it, what he says is that those of us trained in the fall redemption one want to eagerly get into that problem, and therefore maybe don't get into the blessing enough, that we're worried about the abuse or whatever it is. So my reaction too, certainly because of my training and probably experience, is, you know, well now, wait a minute, how can we hold this in and everything else? And he's saying, well, blessing is blessing. That's the bounty. That's everything coming down. If when they see the food coming down, they say, oh man, now we could abuse this. Right away, it's not going to taste as good. It's not going to be savored as well. And I think what he's saying, and especially I feel he's saying in the first one, is, man, it's there. Woman, it's there. Blessing, blessing, blessing. Enjoy. Pleasure. Don't hold back. And in the very next one, here's how, that interaction, the next one, he says, even letting go of that is part of the via negativa, the theology of the cross, so that even the savoring isn't an end in itself. You know, the struggle is still there. But he's wary, or he says our fall redemption mindset gets us right away in how can it be abused. Is that fair? I mean, that seems to be, to me, what he's trying to come at.
Maybe those who hoard the manna don't know that it is manna.
But it seems to me that I hear a mind, one of those filters that, you know, I still hear this filtering that that you're almost creating an image where here comes this gift, and immediately you want to know what you have to do in order to earn it,
mm-hmm.
or in order to keep it, or in order to be worthy of
mm-hmm.
it. And
that to understand that that is a filter,
mm-hmm.
that is not necessarily coming out of the gift,
mm-hmm.
the situation of being gifted, that giving a present, giving to another, a mother giving to her child nourishment and security and safety, doesn't consider any of those things.
Mm-hmm.
Abundance, keeping it,
mm-hmm.
earning it, being worthy of it. All of those elements, you hear this, we start talking about blessing and we start talking about worthiness and
mm-hmm.
and sharing and
mm-hmm.
all that. The question that comes to me on this one of blessing, do we have abundance? I mean, if you agree with what he's saying, that there is abundance, there is blessing, how do you put that against your statistics?
Mm-hmm.
That you just gave us. I mean, our minds would say, what abundance, what blessing, when you read those kind of statistics.
Mm-hmm.
There's abundance in the 2% of people that own 70% of the world.
I mean, she would say, if you're in poverty, where is your sense of blessing?
Sure.
If you're suffering,
sure.
where is that blessing?
Especially if the blessing is now.
Yep.
If it's not a future blessing,
right.
that's I understand that. But if the blessing is now, where is it?
Yeah. If you're the
right.
woman in Ethiopia with the
yeah,
little baby with the flies all over her face,
right.
sitting
mm-hmm.
there, where is that blessing? Or if you are sitting at the foot of the cross,
mm-hmm.
watching Christ die,
mm-hmm.
where is that original blessing?
I suspect we who aren't there are the ones who can't answer that question, because I experience more hope from the few people that I know that are really poor than I do from the people that are lathering in whatever else it is. And that sounds, looking down and say, well, you ought to be enjoying it. But I don't mean that they're satisfied and don't want to change what is there. But I think they sometimes savor a heck of a lot better than us who are filled with Cheerios or whatever else it is.
But the question for me is, if it is true
mm-hmm.
that we have this creative energy which has totally provided all our needs, and on the other hand, we have this situation that we consider to be a total loss, total disaster. If this is true, then this must not be true. It must not be a total disaster. It must not be the end of everything. It must not be the most horrible thing.
I think that's what he says in Via Negativa. And I think we're unwilling to believe that.
Yeah.
And Fox says we're called to believe that. Or he's trying to issue a call to believe that. I don't think he says it as plainly as I do. That's that interweaving again. In the book, you got to wait until you get to the this next section, but it's woven into what we're doing right now. To look at the blessing is to be aware of unblessing or whatever you want to call it. What else? Again, the goal is to stir you up to be doing more thinking and reflecting about that, and we will be coming back, but let's take our second group that was talking about humility and earthiness. Number two, who's got something to say in response? I forget who is in the group. Oh, Sandy, Linda, and you. Okay, what are you going to, anything to stir us up with?
Well, we looked for a definition for humility in the monks, and we finally decided that what he was saying was that it was earthiness and not connectedness to the earth.
Well, what does that mean to you?
Well, Wendell Berry says it this way. Groping for interconnectedness between spirit and body, body and other bodies, and the body and earth, and the care of both is the same.
Mm-hmm.
if we don't care for our bodies, then we are not caring for the earth. If we don't care for the earth, we are not caring for our bodies.
Okay. Any other comments or things that bothered you or that you shared with one another? Do you think that contributes to, as just, again, your experience, Tipper, thinking of earthiness in that sense rather than humility in earthiness sense rather than in some other sense? Does that contribute to pride, or does that contribute to a better understanding? What's your opinion
that's,
about that?
Well, that's usually the definition, I think, for humility. The opposite is being prideful. But we didn't think that it meant that.
Mm-hmm. What does humility mean for you other than in Fox's definition? Did you talk about that?
Well, I was just going to go on with what he says.
Mm-hmm. You didn't?
Mm-hmm. Repression is not humility. Mm-hmm. Repression of our instincts or our love or what we do or don't do.
Anybody else? Go ahead.
What would you do with that verse in Philippians, do nothing from selfishness or conceit, but in humility count others better than yourselves? That definition doesn't work in that verse, does it?
Not for what he's saying.
I wonder.
Do nothing from selfishness or conceit, but in humility count others better than yourselves.
Well, what would you say that is saying as you read it there?
No, I don't know. I guess traditionally I've always read it as sort of a self-denying or a self-lowering or a self-abasing, which is...
And he says, don't deny, save it.
I mean, I don't know how he can give a new definition to a word that we have just because of its origins. Maybe it should have meant that.
Who was he talking to?
This Paul and Andrew? To the Philippians, and he's talking about joy and the Lord. And
that's what I got out. That's what I got out of Bill's intro. Sounds like one of those things that you can't, it's not universal, or it's not something you can apply to all situations. Christ said the same thing, didn't he, when he said you go into a banquet or to have dinner at someone's house, take the lowest seat or the worst place. Don't go to the head of the table necessarily, just take a humble place, and for some people that's what they need to do. They should look for the lowest and they should try to be more humble.
I have questions about that. I wonder if that's Christian. Very good. The need for people to be humble is overwhelming. And to me, it's always a suspicious sign of work righteousness. The need to be a servant is engrossing and often can be the opposite of the grace of God. I wonder how much the passage would be changed if we just said, when you come to this place and all these people are there, remember your earthiness. Your connection with the earth already gives you all that it has. So why in the world, if you're going to go into a place like that where the tables are up here, why do you have to go up to the top one? You got it all, no matter where you sit, because you're connected to the earth. It seems to me it wouldn't necessarily destroy or distort what Paul is saying there. That maybe, whether Paul knew it or not, maybe the Greek word, it'd be fun to play with the Greek word and find out what was behind that there too. that maybe he was saying something akin to that without knowing it at all. I mean, without being able to define it in that way. But he was saying that, that's a sign. You're letting other people do whatever they want because you're connected to the earth as a sign of the manna, as a sign of the rule of God. Or as a sign of the bounty. If you've got the bounty, why do you have to push other people aside if that would be what you were doing? But to say that it is self-negation, or, you know, to put yourself down or something, maybe achieves similar things, but maybe, you know, doesn't affirm the via positiva, the blessing.
What would you do if he humbled himself and became obedient unto death?
I think it's an incarnational statement. He became of the earth. We use it frequently. I mean, the Philippians passage is used in incarnational thinking and teaching, and so he became of the earth.
We just did the Sun Ash Wednesday, and when I learned the meaning of humble, the Ash Wednesday liturgy, the dust, and the words remember. It's really remember your humus.
Your humus.
But when he humbled himself, he didn't hate himself.
No way.
Or he didn't dislike himself, or he didn't devalue himself or consider himself unworthy. He saw his worthiness in every place that he was, even into the place of servant. He saw the tremendous value of those that serve. And so he lifted up the servers as the highest good. Instead of saying he devalued those who are low and humble, he took those who are the lowest and the humblest and showed their true value.
Maybe Paul's would have been easier to make this association than turned around if he had said, do not consider others higher than yourself. What he said was, consider others higher than you.
But that isn't what Fox is saying, because he says, don't repress yourself. Acknowledge your gifts. And
no, I can see this connection. For me, it'd be a little easier if you phrase it the other way.
I think, too, though, it's still a choice. You know, some people can make that choice, and others have it made for them.
Oh, sure.
And so, I guess I think in terms of the struggle that women have had to find a place and to experience themselves, to constantly be told that they're good because they've been servants, is to deny so much of what women have to offer. Therefore, when I hear some of this, I just find myself struggling, you know, internally with that sense of call to serve, you know, a choice to serve. You know, I may choose to do that, but I'm going to be seen as somebody who doesn't have value. And sometimes that hurts a lot. And so, I don't know. I don't know what humility is either, because I think it's been screwed up so much by the way we tend to put people into positions.
That's why, as some of you already know, I just avoid the word servant like mad in this society, because I think if it's the abuse of that word is always it's looked at. I think there's a biblical good understanding that comes out if we would be able to get back into that. But here, and then as I said the other night again, if Jesus said at the end, I don't call you servants anymore, but I call you friends. That, you know, my friend is closer to me. He's not, if you're called out to be a friend, it isn't like, you know. And you still might be, quote, serving others. But the word avoids, this is society translation of that word, just as a put down thing. The university I was at, they screamed at the concept of serving because of what it meant. And I think it was largely the one. I was in university that said that.
Yeah, and it's, well, we mentioned it's interesting, both in the Hebrew covenant community and in the early church, you could not be a slave. Mm-hmm. So that was in terms of society.
You also talked this morning about how that changed and how
the
men won.
Sure.
By the end of the, what, first century?
Mm-hmm.
Well, by the time Ephesians was written, slave, freedom.
He talked to slaves then.
Yeah. Spiritualized.
Mm-hmm. Can you maybe argue that her discourse that we should continue to use the word servant?
Sure.
Because it only has bad connotations in our Egyptian pyramid way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And it, whenever you say that and it brings that out, then it would right away you think of that system, that we aren't part of the system where we are in unity. Therefore, the word doesn't have good connotations. And as long as it doesn't, maybe we should keep using it and keep saying what it means, because it reminds us so well of what we aren't or haven't become yet.
Or maybe we just need to change the hierarchy structure.
Well, that's what we'd be doing.
Well, I think we need somehow or other to find a new way to do what we do, and then we'll understand. Those at the top will understand what it means to serve. I don't think that we can, that'll ever be understood unless we turn it upside down.
How do we turn slavery upside down?
We don't. Well, I don't mean.
No. How did we?
How did we?
How did we? You know, at what point do you say slavery ended? Slavery ends when people actually, you know, when does slavery end? Does slavery end when people actually are free? Mm-hmm. Or does slavery end the minute that a slave realizes that he's free?
Right.
And for women, did the oppression of women end when men cease to seek to oppress women? Or does the oppression of women end the minute they see who they really are? When I read Matthew Fox, I see him saying, don't repress yourself, but see.
Yeah.
But see what I see in that I created you. See what I see. And if I take it away from humanity and I see it as a shell or a tree or a heron or a molecule and the form of that molecule, and I look at it and I know that is a beautiful thing. It's a right thing. It's in the right place. And so that at that moment that I see that's who I am created by God. I have this place in the universe. I'm free. Mm. You could seek to oppress me.
Mm-hmm.
You could succeed in oppressing me.
Right.
You could take my life.
Yeah.
But still wouldn't touch my freedom.
Okay, yeah. How do you get to that? How did women get to that point? How did slaves get to that point?
Were they sold?
Yeah.
How does anybody get to that point? Because what we were talking about, if you're on the edge of despair and you're in the moment of darkness, is that blessing not there for you? Or if that blessing is there, just simply because you don't know that it's there?
Right, it's there. Come out of the darkness when you recognize
that. That's where our family comes in. In Christ we are a family, and that support system that we all need. And part of raising a child or of anything is over and over again. And you get down and you need your fellow brother and sister to treat you like a
blessing.
Yeah, and also like a member of the king's family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you have pride and dignity and self-worth. And even in a Christian community, we devalue each other and do it unconsciously. Even we're aware of it, and then we do it to each other.
Yes.
Before you let go of this idea of servant, did it have a better connotation in Christ's day? Better than that?
The
was it interpreted wrong?
There's, I think, if I recall, 7 or 8 words in the Greek for servanthood, some of which were ambassadorial rank. And so there was a whole range of what it may be. Joe Bash is old. Do you remember that? The servant little book Joe did out of the ALC office, I think I got a copy of it somewhere, was an exploration of all of those words because he was trying to do as he was recouping it for that. I wouldn't argue with anybody who said they want to recover it and all of that, but it's a much broader spectrum than we would think of, and certainly in a Christian context, it didn't do what the debasing kind of thing, feeling bad about yourself. The question is, how well can we cut through that and do it today with everything that's around us?
Wasn't it Joseph who was called a servant and had charge of all the money?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's the Old Testament.
Yeah, yeah. We think of it more in terms of upstairs, downstairs.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if the difference of the new society of Jesus is that everybody in the community is a servant.
Mm-hmm.
And we're serving is a problem is when you have some that aren't.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the, because if everybody is a servant, then everybody else will get served and gets back rows. And all kinds of other foot washings. So.
Okay. We're running out of time again. We've got a minute to wrap up. Sorry we don't get back to those others.
Have to start with group 3 and 4.
Yeah, we should really do
less
that.
Less controversial.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, if we'd have got into even death can be trusted, I think we'd have had some problems there. Yeah.
Could I ask the group if since sure. Got started to do this, could we do dishes?
Well, I can give only permissions.
Yeah, he's my dish team captain. We're on today.
Oh, you're on.
But if he says I can stay and you want to, that's fine. We'll take another. Okay. All right. How about the third one on theme 5? Who had that? Okay. Want to share some things that you?
We skipped theme 4.
Oh, did we skip?
Yeah, we skipped theme 4, but nobody had it as time.
That's right. I jumped up here. I just picked out some of the themes. There were too many for us to get in. So theme 5. Any of
trust
you?
Go ahead. The opposite of fear.
Okay.
Fear is following redemption. Theology teaches us fear of nature, fear of ourselves, fear of others. But he kind of is a lot of examples we can look to trust roots. And he tells you the wisdom literature. The date in King David, he came to the realization, this is about 83, half of 84. The whole thing with trust again, the word he uses, he interchanges it with faith. Go your way, your trust has healed you. So it's not a psychological issue, it's the faith issue. And so it begins with David, and when David realizes that he's trusted by God, letting himself be trusted, and he brings in Krugman's quote, what God does first and best and most is to trust his people with their moment in history. He trusts his people to do what must be done for the sake of his whole community. And then I'll say, then it goes on about Jesus in the parable of the talents.
Mm-hmm.
And all throughout this chapter, it's expanding and growing. And parable of the talents is to expand our talents, trust in our gifts, not bury them out of fear. Yeah, David, maybe you want to say something about that. You're talking about relationships with other people. That's a big thing. How we fear, how we're reserved, the change.
Well, you know, just bringing forth ideas of why do we not be ourselves at times? And so it was really a conversation more about fierce. I think we are in such reserve at times because we fear embarrassment, we fear ridicule, we fear social work. Whereas if our center was more towards, or at least perhaps a way to step out of that predicament, is to think of oneself in trust with God, that you are a full person, blessed by God, and so on, that your reaction, what you do, shouldn't be on a basis of fellow individuals that put you down, so to speak, but rather that you are not nourished by them, you are nourished by God. You are. I didn't explain it very well. I'm not doing it very well now. But in terms of how you see yourself in relationship to other persons, first see yourself in relationship between you and God, which makes you a full person, which accepts you as you are. There's no reservations. There's a full trust in Him. Your standard, your goals are with God, who doesn't have them. Does the things that these fears are brought up, mm-hmm. in that sense.
And how other people react to us is out of their fear, you know. Mm-hmm. This chain of fear. So we fear other people's reactions to us because they might alienate us or something. So instead of looking at it that way, we said break the chain of fear, implement the chain of trust.
I think
we talked a lot about how trust is a growing thing. Inevitably, it must grow.
Mm-hmm.
It's not being afraid of expanding our gifts and growing. And then this is part of my growing. We come to the ideas like Meister Eckhart, what he calls our ultimate growth and the growth into divinity,
mm-hmm.
that a seed becomes what it was originally, and we have the seed of God in us, therefore ultimate growth is to the seed of God grows into God. Well, that's kind of mind-boggling to me. But then the trust of death, and what does that mean, the trust of, except that you think of it as the opposite of fear, but how he talks about this is all part of the natural cycle that we go towards this, just as all creation does. And so therefore, you trust death in accepting it as part of this natural cycle.
And expansion and growth.
Yeah,
and he says, Paul, redemption teaches you that death is bad, death is evil, death is, that's where you want to avoid like the plague, if you will, which is a terrible illustration. That is, yeah, please do. And but in this, if it's trusting, then even that, if the creation entrusted to humanity, by the way, not only to the Christians or the believers, but to humanity, I always have to remember that, that part of that creation is also what we call death. And we also trust that as being part of the, what shall we say, the expansion of the blessing.
So if you take that part of that resurrection also.
Yeah?
In your original sin idea, had you you feared it because this was what happened to you as a result of
sin.
Sure.
And that focus, that emphasis, or that preoccupation, he says, is what distorts that. What are dealing with the via negativa, which we'll be doing it, is trying to share with us. To start at that point gets us too fast into a distortion.
And he mentions too that we are only at the beginning of creation, that our whole life is just going to be a creative process.
He uses the example of the hospice movement to show that death can be trusted. People that are dying teach the living so much in those last hours, those ones around them, the nurses' aides, trust this death. You know, it's another transformation, they're just another cycle of life. And so that's been a real good way to understand that death too can be trusted, I think. It's our culture that has problems with that. I don't think Native Americans would have, I don't know. How do I see that?
Big topic. Talk about that. But now, there is a creation-centered spirituality that doesn't adopt the idea that death is awful.
Another quote that gave me food for thought was that compassion is a function of faith in human nature, while compulsion is a function of lack of faith in human nature. And I see there that my blame is put on the fall redemption. Showing lack of faith in human nature, and so therefore you say you can't really have compassion with the
to feel with, and again, with this dance, it's everyone is a servant, you feel with, or when it's a friend, you feel with the compassion, this trust of one another.